From the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast, this is U.S. Farm Report.
Welcome to U.S. Farm Report this weekend. I'm Tyne Morgan, and here's what's in store over the next 60 minutes. The results are in. Americans love eating red meat.
The public wants meat in their diet. I think their ability to pay for it is going to improve in the next 24 months.
Celebrating the unofficial kickoff to grilling season with a look at current demand for meat. Dreams really do come true.
It's just kind of taken off and it's been wildly successful.
How one first-generation cattle company is carving out convenience with a vending machine full of meat. Rough waters for the Biden administration's Clean Water Act. How a Supreme Court ruling could force the EPA to change course on WOTUS. And in John's world.
When was America settled?
Now for the news, a significant Supreme Court ruling this week that ruled against the EPA, and the ruling could force the agency to change course on the waters of the U.S. The Supreme Court siding with an Idaho couple this week in its battle against the EPA over the waters of the U.S. rule. The court concluding the government was wrong to use the Clean Water Act to prevent a couple from building a house on wetlands near one of Idaho's largest lakes. EPA Administrator Michael Regan says the ruling, quote, erodes long-standing clean water protections, end quote. The American Farm Bureau Federation says the EPA overstepped its authority under the Clean Water Act by restricting private property owners from developing their land. Several ag groups have come out and applauded the Supreme Court's decision this week.
I think the first question that we all asked is, how is this going to impact the Biden administration's WOTUS rule that was released earlier this year, that went into effect in March? So the significant nexus test really is the cornerstone of that rule. So I think there's certainly going to be a requirement on the Biden administration to, at a minimum, pull that rule back for some significant revisions.
Three Western states have come up with a historic deal to significantly reduce their water usage from the Colorado River. California, Arizona, and Nevada agreed to cut around 10% of their state's Colorado River allocation, which is equal to 3 million acre-feet of water. An acre-foot covers 1 acre of land 1 foot deep. Now, the water cuts would be split up among farmers, tribes, and cities who are working with the federal government on short-term payments in exchange for water savings. The state's forced to make cuts as the Colorado River has experienced several years of drought along with increased demand.
If we're going to be successful in this effort to move forward and push our way up and deal with these problems, which we are, and I've never been more optimistic in my life than I am right now.
The deal allows the federal government to make additional cuts if water levels fall further, but that is less likely after a heavy snow season. High heat and little rain means flash drought concerns are now popping up across the Corn Belt. That's as many farmers have wrapped up planting ahead of Memorial Day. USDA says 81% of the corn crop across the country is in the ground. But look at North Dakota. Only one-third of the corn was planted as of Monday, and many farmers may have run out of time. The crop insurance deadline for corn planting was May 25th, and that means more farmers may be forced to take prevent plant. But now the focus is on the dryness. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says Chicago is heading for its second driest May on record. And this week's drought monitor showing while rains helped improve the drought situation across Texas and Oklahoma, drought actually expanded in parts of Iowa and Illinois. And then check out NOAA's temperature forecast for next week. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration forecasting temps to hit close to 100 degrees in a pocket of northern Illinois. After a rapid run-up in farmland prices, the market is now seeing a sudden slowdown. And one land expert telling me it's a change that's only occurred within the past 2 months. Jim Rothermich of Iowa Appraisal says the buyer pool has shrunk, and it's not just due to fewer farmers buying land, but also shrinking interest from outside investors. So check this out. He says in 2022, Iowa saw 19 farmland sales of over $20,000 per acre. So far this year, there have been 11, but 8 of those happened in the first 3 months of the year. Rothermich says farmland isn't the scalding market like we saw in 2022, and the biggest hit is coming from lower quality ground with an uptick in the number of no sales at auction. Rothermich says the biggest two drivers are lower commodity prices and high input costs, with interest rates coming in third.
Interest rates have some influence, but there's so much cash reserves out there, it hasn't taken full effect. So in time, as those cash reserves get depleted in the countryside, those interest rates will start affecting land values. So I expect in the next 12 months, I would say we have a potential for a 10% price correction in the land market.
One Ukrainian port has stopped operations, the government claiming Russia is not allowing ships to enter it. It's the port of Pivdini. It's near Odessa on the Black Sea. A Ukrainian official saying the port is being cut out of the Black Sea grain deal right now. As we reported last week, Russia and Ukraine just agreed to extend the deal for 2 months. The United Nations, which helped broker the original agreement last summer and the latest extension, expressed concern about the port being shut off. All right, that's it for the news. Well, it looks to be dry across much of the country this weekend. Perfect if you want to get outside. But there are concerns about flash drought. We'll have a check of weather coming up next.
U.S. Farm Report weather is brought to you by H&S Manufacturing. The new 1200 Series Big Dog forage boxes now feature new heavy-duty dual gearbox-driven apron chains and are available in 26 and 30-foot models. Find out more about the Big Dog boxes at the H&S website.
Time now for a check of weather. Courtney Jorgensen joins us this weekend. Courtney, flash drought concerns are building. And as you look at the forecast next week, it's not only going to be dry for some, but we're talking about some major heat.
That's right, Tyne. On top of the drought concern, we also have a significant amount of heat, as well as those lower precipitation amounts forecasted across the nation. Take a look at the drought monitor right now. Still looking at that exceptional drought through portions of the Central Plains out there. That was a continuing trend last year as well, too, and even down into portions of Florida as well, where we are looking at an extreme drought also. Taking a look at our root zones and what that means for us, just updated, you can see that still significant, very dry to extremely dry conditions as far as our root zones are concerned. And that's a similar thing off towards the northwest as too. A bit over on the east coast, that is continuing to become more dry as well. Now, we can certainly use that rain, unfortunately, especially for portions of the northern Great Lakes. They're not going to be seeing much of it. It'll be close to normal as we head into the start of June, actually, that whole first week of June, but over towards the southwest, we'll actually start to pick up a little bit more precipitation as far as our outlook is concerned. That ridging system that we have been watching as far as the jet stream is concerned does continue for a bit longer. Take a look as we head through Monday. We're still looking at that ridging as we head into Wednesday. That continues on into Thursday, Friday, same kind of thing. We'll start to see a little bit of a break in that as we head into next weekend. Hopefully we're going to be keeping our eye on that, especially over towards the northeast where we start to see some of those effects. We could really use that rain shower along with that. As we were talking about the heat, take a look at that temperature outlook over the next couple of days. You can see well above normal temperatures for the northern half of the country. This is pretty significant, certainly below normal temperatures over towards the southwest. Now, as we take a look at what's going to be happening ahead as we head into Monday, high pressure still dominating the area. That's that ridge out there. We'll see a bit of moisture through the central portions of the country where they could use it. So that'll be fantastic, even a bit over on the east coast as well. Then as we head into Wednesday, high pressure still in place. Those chances for rain showers do become much more isolated, as you can see, maybe in the central portions of the country, a bit into the northwest over the mountains as well too. But as we put this in motion and on into Friday, there's that high pressure still kicking on. The good news is, especially for the Great Lakes, that's when we start to see that next chance for some rain showers over in the Great Lakes and picking up a bit into the south and also over into the northwest. All of these areas could certainly use more rain showers as those drought conditions do continue to increase out there. Well, we will take any rain we can get.
Thanks, Courtney. Well, speaking of the dryness and the weather, is it starting to catch the attention of the markets yet? Chip Nellinger and Mike North join me for our marketing roundtables next. Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report this Memorial Day weekend. All right, as we kind of kick off the summer and as we look at weather, it seems like weather is impacting the markets. Chip, we're seeing warmer, drier forecast for next week, but it seems a little bit early to be talking about that for corn prices specifically.
Yeah, it is very early. I think that's why the market's been a little bit reluctant to put a big rally in. We have covered a few shorts in the corn market. We pushed up to the 20-day moving average and couldn't do much above there. I think once we get past the Memorial Day weekend here, you know, long weekends always tend to kind of hamper the market's ability to do much under the worry that the forecast will do a 180 over a long weekend. But if we come back in Monday night, Tuesday morning, and we still see a forecast that takes us into mid-June that has no measurable rain in it, I think then the market starts getting a little more worried about this dry weather continuing into the last half of June.
Well, the other extreme of that, though, Mike, we look in North Dakota, where they had a slow start to planting. Well, here we are now, past this crop insurance date, as farmers look at either switching crops or taking the Prevent plant. As you have conversations, what are more North Dakota farmers doing this year? Because it is a different market situation than we saw a year ago.
It is. $5.91 spring price on crop insurance has a lot of people considering the Prevent plant option, because we are moving into that final plant date. And, while there are some that are considering the route of soybeans, that still requires fields to be ready. And I think as you look at the options today with the cost of production where they're at and what the markets have recently done, that Prevent plant option is becoming more attractive all the time. So as we look at the broader base of acres further north in the Corn Belt, specifically North Dakota, you might see some get lost.
Overall, do you think that USDA is missing the mark, specifically when it comes to the new crop demand, Chip?
Well, I think that's the big question in the market's mind. And I go back a couple weeks to the May crop report showing, 181 bushel and 181 and a half national average yield in corn, 52 on beans. And the market, due to some, pretty poor, arguably very poor export sales weeks here, is worried about demand, and rightfully so. But to Mike's point earlier, you shave a million acres off of corn and you take 3 or 4 bushels off of the national average yield, and all of a sudden we're back under a 2 billion bushel carryout, and the market now is assuming we've got somewhere north of a 2 billion bushel carryout. My point with that is, going back, the weather definitely does matter here going into June and July, and it wouldn't take much of a threat to shave that back, even in spite of the market's assumption right now that demand is a real problem. And I'm not sure that, that's warranted right now. When South America and Brazil in particular comes out of their harvest, we usually have a lull in our exports on both corn and beans anyway. So this isn't seasonally unheard of. If this comes roaring back into late summer and we put a threat on the market, then we're going to be way too low priced here.
I mean, what is the possibility that we do see that demand come roaring back, Mike?
Well, I think ultimately if weather starts to rear its ugly head, it comes back pretty quick. I mean, if you look at the setup right now, we've had a big crop in Brazil, and that's helped to offset some of the losses in Argentina. We're expecting a big crop in the United States. But a part of that discussion revolves around an El Nino pattern that ultimately is very favorable to U.S. yields typically. But in that same breath, El Nino is not so favorable to a South American crop. So as we work into the summer and start looking at projections around a Brazilian production number, we may have to temper those a little bit. And now back to Chip's point, we're starting to, shrink the global balance sheet again. And then that's where people get excited. But I think what's been a struggle for us right now is that big South American crop that did come to the ports is weighing heavily on cash prices there. And last look, we have corn prices about 70 cents lower than the U.S. and beans at about $1.70. It's very difficult for us to compete with that. And that's why you're seeing some of these cancellations on corn and why we're posting negative net sales numbers on the week. It's a tough environment right now. It's one that could change very quickly. And so, just like we say in Wisconsin with regard to weather, if you don't like it, wait 5 minutes. And that's kind of how this thing could go as we come through the summer.
Well, what is the path of least resistance when it comes to cattle prices? We need to get in dairy as well, as milk takes center stage at the Indy 500. So we'll talk markets coming up later on U.S. Farm Report. Well, a little history lesson this Memorial Day weekend as we head to John's Farm for John's World this week.
As far back as I can remember, which varies greatly now, the right answer to the question, when did humans first come to the Americas, was a number around 10,000 years ago. Over time, archaeologists kept uncovering surprising fossils and remains and adding dating tools. Most absolute dating methods are radiometric, based on radioactive decay in minerals. There are new relative dating approaches like paleopollenology, the examination of pollen captured in fossils. One big new change is DNA analysis, especially for human remains. DNA changes occur sequentially, so scientists can figure out where and often when in human evolution any remains fit, thus establishing a time range and sometimes a location. At any rate, as geologists refine major events like glaciation periods, paleontologists have better benchmarks to approximate human expansion from our origins in Africa. For the Americas, there is a rough consensus that the occupation of the Americas occurred during the last glacial maximum, LGM, about 40,000 years ago. Then, with ocean levels much lower, as water was locked up in the ice, the Bering Strait between Siberia and Alaska was joined into Beringia. However, conditions that would make the land bridge passable didn't occur until 10 to 20,000 years ago, hence the long-standing acceptance of the human settlement date. Archaeologists, though, kept finding fossils and shreds of evidence of human activity that have gradually begun to push the date back. In 2020, a cave in Mexico offered up some tantalizing hints of earlier arrival in the form of well-preserved mammoth remains, bones apparently split with stone tools and gathered neatly under a fossilized mammoth skull. The artifacts could be as old as 30,000 years ago. The tools that were used were also possibly identified. Other intriguing sites have suggested dates in the 20 to 25,000 years ago range. The debate continues among paleontologists, but if these finds do establish earlier settlement of the Americas, they also changed how people probably got here. The Beringia land bridge didn't just pop up dry and ready to run across. It was boggy and often impassable until the sea receded further. To get here that early would suggest a sea route hugging the western coast, followed later by the overland treks down the Continental Divide. This nautical theory would in turn revise thinking about early seafaring skills and population dispersion patterns. As fascinating as I found this discussion, it revealed to me we not only have trouble predicting the future, we can barely predict our past.
Well, it's a fan favorite this weekend for Tractor Tales, the story behind a John Deere 4020 in Illinois and one he bought brand new. Machinery Pete takes us to Mineral, Illinois next.
Closed captioning on U.S. Farm Report is brought to you by BASF. BASF, helping you to do the biggest job on earth.
I bought it new in 1970. I was farming 1,400 acres and had 100 head of cows, probably 250 acres of corn and 200 of soybeans. Wholeheartedly, we just look at it, make it look pretty. My son, Rick, he painted it and overhauled it. And I can't say it was in rough shape, but it was didn't look like it does today. I think I used it around 9,000 hours. It has 11 on it now. It was a good plower in this day. Well, it brings back a lot of memories, a lot of good times and some bad times. I farmed in this tractor from 1970 till 1999, and that's 29 years and still was a good tractor. In the meantime, I'd put a blower on it, and I and another fellow, we put it on his International and my Deere at the same time. One time I had a little trouble with injection pump. Something about a circle broke in there, and they put it on the dyno, and it was turning 180 horse. They didn't run it long that way, and I didn't either. I'm retired. I'm kind of on call for when they need me.
Thanks, Greg. I can see why so many do like those 40-20s. Well, it's Memorial Day weekend, the unofficial kickoff to grilling season, and even with inflation, meat demand is surprising. We'll tell you why. Plus, a vending machine full of meat? Yep, it's real. And we have the backstory, so don't go anywhere. We have so much more to share this Memorial Day weekend.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast. Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. Trusted, timely, tradition.
A new study from Newsweek shows out of 1,500 Americans, the majority not only regularly eat meat, but view it as a healthy choice. And 81% say they consume meat at least once a week. And this Memorial Day weekend means it's a long weekend with more cookouts, which is good news as it's also firing up meat demand. As the unofficial start to grilling season kicks off this Memorial Day weekend, it could be a big weekend for meat demand.
From what I've seen of the weather forecast, it looks like we're going to have clear sailing for firing up a lot of grills.
Favorable weather could help entice more cookouts, even as inflation is dampening some of that demand.
The first thing I'm going to say is it's still very good. Now, with that said, are we clearly seeing signs of softening demand across all species? We absolutely are.
And with the Federal Reserve weighing the possibility of more rate hikes yet this year, the impact on meat demand is something economists are watching.
We have some things we need to be watching, and certainly as inflationary pressures, recessionary threats impact consumer spending, we're seeing it in the meat case.
There's no denying that inflation has put pressure on many Americans. Kansas State University economist Glenn Tonser is watching that closely with the monthly meat demand monitor.
Specifically about the middle of 2022, depends on the cut and the species and the product of what month I'd say it peaked. But somewhere between April and July of 2022 is what I would call the peak.
Tonser says you have to keep in mind that while demand did peak, it was at historically high levels. And today, domestic demand is softening.
My opinion is that the broader macroeconomic situation, and even more narrowly, personal finances for many households are putting a pinch on wallets.
The surge in meat demand, despite higher prices, happened longer than many economists even thought. One reason may be the number of Americans who built up their savings during the pandemic from less travel and staying at home more. Add to that all the pandemic payments from the federal government. According to IRS data, three rounds of stimulus money created more than 476 million payments, and the grand total, more than $814 billion.
And that allowed a bigger cushion to absorb higher meat prices, and households remained willing to do that for some time as long as they had those built-up savings.
Now that those pandemic payments have stopped, households have chewed through those extra savings, and inflation is also waning. That's why Tonser says the meat demand monitor shows financial sentiments are waning.
We ask how your financial situation for your household is now compared to 1 year ago, and there's more people that say it's worse, and there's fewer people that say it's better, both compared to April of 22 and April of 21.
There are still several silver linings, and one of those is the longer-term trend in meat demand.
Meat protein demand in the U.S. is still higher today than it was before the pandemic. So this is not doomsday per se. It's comparing to a fairly high peak that we had, you know, roughly a year ago in many of these metrics. So yes, demand has eased, but some context is important.
Don Close says at the retail level, the current price spread on retail pork versus pork cutouts is creating a very unusual situation.
The retail pork prices are softer than they were, but still right at their highs. But the price spread between retail pork prices and pork cutout values is incredibly wide.
But beef is seeing the opposite story play out. He says even with the current drop in cow slaughter, the percentage of heifers in the fed slaughter mix is still incredibly high, a sign liquidation will continue.
Because of the weather influences, particularly across the northern feeding states, this market has performed as if it is a sprint, and this market is a marathon. We haven't got to our tightest numbers yet, so this market will, by all rights, should continue 23, 24, and even into 25.
It's a situation meat packers are also grappling today. The latest Sterling profit tracker shows beef packer margins have declined significantly from $177 per head a year ago to just over $23 per head profits today.
If you look at packer earnings across the board, and even all species, I have been surprised at how rapidly those earnings have eroded.
Americans are still hungry for protein and specifically meat.
The public wants meat in their diet. I think their ability to pay for it is going to improve in the next 24 months, specifically on pork and chicken.
And Close's request this holiday weekend to help that demand, well, it's short and sweet.
I just encourage consumers to go out there and fire up those grills.
Driving demand one grill at a time as peak summer demand heats up. Now, Don Close thinks cattle contraction will continue, and that means even higher cattle prices in the months ahead. But do our analysts agree? Mike North and Chip Nellinger rejoin us for our Marketing Roundtables next. Welcome back. Chip Nellinger and Mike North rejoining us. Well, Chip, in our Farm Journal report, you know, we talked about kind of domestic demand softening a bit, but that was expected off of the highs that we've seen. Export demand, specifically with pork, is pretty good. But when you look at cattle today, what do you think is the path of least resistance when it comes to cattle prices this year?
Well, to me, it's certainly higher. You know, they've tried to break this cattle market. They can't, you know, we did have a couple weeks of lower cash trade, but it's right back going to be higher this week. And the futures look like the path of least resistance is higher. You look at deferred feeder cattle making new contract highs almost on a daily basis, and something's got to give. Deferred live cattle either have to rally to bring some profitability back to the feeding sector, or feeder cattle have to break. And the numbers are tight enough that it doesn't look like feeder cattle can break here. So the big thing, the take home though is, and we've been worried about this for 9 months, can the consumer continue to support these higher beef prices? Eventually, these higher prices will ration demand, but right now it doesn't look like we're at a high enough level that that's starting to happen. And the path of least resistance, at least in my mind, is easily for higher in the cattle complex.
Well, Mike, I know, you know, dairy producers with more beef on dairy, we're seeing a large focus on the cattle market too. But when it comes to the dairy market, I know today the situation is oversupply. But as we see USDA coming out with an announcement this week, what was that announcement and could it change the game possibly for dairy demand?
Yeah, we're still digging into the details, but it is a bit of a game changer if the full opportunity is realized. And if you look at it, we had part one of this purchase made last year, and it resulted in about 2 million pounds of cheese being moved into the USDA. And this is going to be used for food banks, local food purchase assistance, schools, above and beyond their normal purchases. And when you break it all down, they're looking for 47 million pounds of cheese. That's 1,900 truckloads of cheese to be delivered somewhere in that neighborhood, we believe, from about October out through next June. So if we go through the bidding process stage by stage and can fully realize that amount of cheese being sold to the government, that's a little bit of a game changer. It starts to put some value back into those fall months, first on cheese and the class three complex, and then secondarily as it creates competition back into that class four market as well. So it is a potential game changer if it's realized, but also know that the bidding process has multiple stages and, you know, they've unveiled what the opportunity could be, but now we have to see which sellers are willing to participate, how much they're willing to allocate, and then in stage two, whether or not they qualify and where the delivery locations are. So it's a complicated and convoluted process. And so you don't really know exactly how big it is until you get to the end. And that could be a couple of months yet.
Well, looking at the pork complex, Chip, you know, we still see relatively high retail pork prices, but, you know, demand is pretty good on the export front when it comes to pork. So what is the battle right now when it comes to these pork prices? And you know, pork producers pretty frustrated at the moment.
Yeah, very frustrating. And it's almost 180 degree turnaround from what we're seeing on the beef side. As you mentioned, we're low enough prices here that demand, export demand, as well as domestic demand is very, very strong right now. The funds are short. They continue to sell every rally. Part of the problem, the first problem, is that the premium and the deferred contracts, and we haven't been able to see that cash market and cutout see much stability or rally. I think the second thing is a lot of fears around this, California legislation that, you know, maybe that could in the short run mean some sow liquidation, maybe some uncertainty about demand out of California. And obviously that's a massive, base of demand on the pork. So I think the combination of that in conjunction with the cash market just not being able to get up and rally yet really has the funds selling every bounce that you see in the market. It's been frustrating. You've seen a couple of days where we've been $2 higher, buck and a half higher, and the next day they give it all back and then some. So we just can't seem to find a footing yet.
And we'll talk quite a bit more about the pork market coming up in a couple of weeks. We'll be at World Pork Expo for a live taping of U.S. Farm Report. But Mike and Chip, thank you so much for joining us this weekend. We appreciate it. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll have much more right here on U.S. Farm Report. A vending machine packed with protein, and not just any protein, but beautiful, high-quality steaks. It all started with a wild idea for a fifth-generation cattle producer, but a first-generation cattle company. And this Memorial Day weekend, we see how one family is serving up the meat while carving out convenience. Nestled along the rolling hills of western Missouri is where you'll find Tim Hare.
I'm the fifth generation of my family to take this on.
A fifth-generation farmer of what's now a first-generation business.
Greengrass Cattle Company started 2 years ago.
After the flood of 1993, the family sold their farm and cattle, and Tim's mom and dad landed jobs off the farm, but still within agriculture.
And then after he retired, he kind of approached us and said, hey, you guys want to make a run at this full time? And after that, we started adding back to the herd and increasing our numbers.
It's growth that hasn't always happened by chance. The Hares are intentional in everything they do.
We first started out, we were just doing selling sides of beef. We didn't have a retail store. We had a small online presence, but we didn't have an e-commerce site or anything.
But when the COVID pandemic hit, demand was on fire, and the Hares knew it was time to dish out something new.
We looked at that as an opportunity to start processing cattle at a USDA facility and then selling individual cuts of beef as well.
And so they did, opening up this storefront in Weston in September of 2021. It was a way for the family to connect with consumers and share the story behind the beef.
I think it's really important, and I think consumers care about it too. You know, the types of questions that we will get are often very detailed, and you can tell that people, you know, want to know that the food that they're eating was raised by a local family or that it was cared for.
Differentiating their business has become Greengrass Cattle Company's specialty. And Tim says it all starts with high quality bulls carefully selected for certain traits.
We weren't concerned about a lot of the other things that traditional producers are looking for. What we were looking for were bulls that had high EPD scores in ribeye size and marbling.
Docile bulls that are Black Angus, sourced from Keneally Angus in Whitman, Nebraska.
And we found great value in buying those, and it's turned out to be a pretty successful venture for us.
The deliberate decisions made here are also ones that can be a bit different, especially when it comes to some of Tim's off-the-wall ideas.
Last year, I had a buddy of mine that moved to Germany, and I was talking to him one evening, and he goes, man, you're not going to believe this, but I get my bratwurst out of a vending machine that's two blocks away from me.
And with that, Tim had an idea: create their own vending machine full of meat.
I researched the different machines that were available. How could I make this work to sell not just bratwurst and ground beef, but steaks even? And I finally found a machine that I liked, that I thought would work and accommodate our needs.
It wasn't just finding the right setup, but also the right location.
Keith Bradley at Made in KC, he really believed in our idea. He's really supported us through this whole venture. And they've got a lot of runway. I think they have close to 15 stores in Kansas City.
That idea is a reality today. Located inside Front Range Coffee House in the middle of Kansas City, which is 40 miles from their farm.
It's just kind of taken off, and it's been wildly successful.
An automated vending machine that even allows Tim to constantly collect data.
In working with the distributor that sells the machines, We were able to find a card reader that actually provides a lot of telematics in real time.
Out of all the aggregated data, the most telling point may be how people will buy steak at any hour of the day.
I didn't know if the machine was going to be successful to start with. When people were buying steaks that late at night, it just kind of validated all the assumptions that I had.
The reviews of Greengrass Cattle Company tell the story best. They've carved out convenience while attracting a loyal customer base across the entire Kansas City area.
We're not that far removed from having a grandpa or an aunt or uncle that lived on a farm, right? That were farmers as a profession. And nowadays, we're just not seeing that as much. And so bringing people closer to ag is a big objective of ours.
Whether it's buying a steak from this vending machine or visiting the family's feed store they just acquired earlier this year, the Hares have not only carved out convenience, but also a niche.
When we first opened up the doors to the store, we were answering questions that ourselves, we just kind of took for granted as knowledge that we had our whole lives. We're not just trying to provide locally raised beef to consumers. We also have an obligation now to educate them and make more of a connection with where our food comes from.
Now, the family says everything they do is intentional and with a purpose. They're actually part of Feed Northland Kids, where they partner with Harvesters, a community food network, to provide kids backpacks full of food. They donate 12,000 pounds of meat a month through that program. All right, when we come back, the decline in religion in the U.S., a follow-up to John's Easter weekend commentary. Customer support is next.
What happened to Sundays?
Well, Easter weekend, John Phipps' commentary about religion did spark some questions and some comments, and he's here to answer one of those viewer notes this weekend in customer support.
Carol Lawrence offers an observation on religion and housework. It seems to me the decline in religion makes sense. When I grew up in the 60s, my mother was a homemaker, and all the stores were closed on Sunday. Now, both spouses generally have to work, and most workplaces are running every day of the week. Therefore, if you aren't working on Sunday, you are getting caught up on household chores. Carol, please send an address for your mug. When I spoke about the decline in religious affiliation, it was to provide some background for social and even political trends to guide our expectations and decisions. The change in customs surrounding weekends, especially Sunday, that Carol mentions, has proven to be a powerful contributor. The 60s were the beginning of the rapid rise of women in the workplace until today, when they comprise almost half. Household chores like shopping were compressed into the weekend, nor were home tasks evenly distributed by gender, and remain so today. Women not only work nearly as many hours as men, but still do a large majority of the childcare, cooking, and other home chores. While this ended some traditional schedules, it was an economic boom. Currently, women not only work, but are increasingly likely to be the major wage earners in a household. Over 60% of college graduates are female, so the probability of women in the higher paying jobs will increase as well. As women entered the labor force, doubled income suddenly gave families more disposable income. To capture that new consumer spending power, stores accommodated the tighter family schedules. Family time was hard to carve out of those schedules, and perhaps church drifted from regular to rare. Work also provided women with social interaction, replacing church activities. Multiple surveys of church attendance suggest other problems as well. An aging membership was the largest influence, along with population stagnation. Female employment has been shown to significantly reduce family size, and childless by choice couples are increasingly common. Church participation in political issues is problematic, energizing some members, but repelling those with contrary views. Church services can seem lame compared to 24/7 entertainment choices, especially with the young. Regardless of the reasons, and I think Carol identifies a key factor, we may soon have a national population where none of the above is the largest religious affiliation.
Well, as American flags are displayed across the country this Memorial Day weekend, one lucky viewer is about to win a beautiful flag display. It's our Zoetta Sweepstakes giveaway, and we're announcing the big winner next. A few weeks ago, we kicked off a sweepstakes called Zoetta's Freedom Recognition Sweepstakes by Farm Journal. We're giving away an American flag wall display, very fitting this Memorial Day weekend. Now, we've been announcing winners throughout the week on Ag Day, and we have the final winner of the last special edition golf bag. Congratulations to Brandon Farrell of Lone Elm Beef Masters. He won that golf bag. And now for our grand prize winner. The winner is Frank Kaler of Homedale Farms in St. Charles, Minnesota. You're the winner of this American flag wall display. Congratulations to all the winners, and thank you for entering. And a special thanks to Zoetis for the Freedom Recognition Sweepstakes by Farm Journal. And speaking of freedom, let's take time this Memorial Day weekend to remember those who died in service to our country. We are the home of the free because of the brave. Thanks for watching, and join us next week as we work to build on our tradition. Have a great weekend, everyone.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast.